You're listening to a Radio 191 FM podcast.
Talking to our first guest very, very shortly. He is the author of a new book called Songs from the Shaky Isles, A Short History of Popular Music in New Zealand. The book provides a vivid account of how popular music arose in our far-flung island nation, from early songs that could only be heard in person to modern hits which spread digitally to all ends of the earth. His previous books include Making Music in New Zealand, Insights, New Zealand Artists Talk About Creativity, NZ Rock 1987 to 2007, and the book Concept Albums. We have author Gareth Shute joining us from Tamaki Makaurau. How are you this morning, Gareth?
Good. Kia ora. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Anytime. Very, very happy to be talking to an expert on New Zealand music.
Thanks.
How long have you been listening to New Zealand music for?
Well, when I was like maybe 8 years old, my uncle bought me True Colours by Split Enz, and that's my first strong memory of listening to New Zealand music, and I became really obsessed with Split Enz, and my family actually moved to Singapore after that, and I spent all my spare time hunting around record stores trying to find the new Split Enz albums, which were pretty hard to find over there.
True. I'm surprised, because I thought they were, they were huge. I'm not too sure what kind of music Singapore imported. Did growing up there have quite a strong influence on your current music tastes?
We were just there 2 years, but I had a breakdance crew with an African-American Hispanic guy in my apartment building, so I was really into hip-hop music quite early on, like 80s, late 80s, and so when I got back to Aotearoa, I was like obsessed with hip-hop music, which did lead through, you know, I was so fascinated that the New Zealand version was so different, and that did lead through to my first book, which was Hip-Hop Music in Aotearoa, so yeah, it did.
That's fantastic. Now, I want to know if you saw the New Zealand music doco's Life in One Chord about Shane Carter and Anchor Me, the Don McGlashan story, at this year's New Zealand International Film Fest.
I'm ashamed to admit that I haven't seen them yet. I almost overdosed after this book, and I am so behind on films and other books on New Zealand music. There's been such an onslaught of great things covering our history. Yeah, I really want to see. Actually, I really want to see both of them. I really love both those artists, but it's bad timing. I probably shouldn't have released my book during film festival. It's kind of crazy timing. I managed to go see Weed Eaters, which I recommend, that New Zealand film. But yes, didn't get to as many films as I would have liked to.
I heard nothing but positive things about Weed Eaters. Unfortunately, I missed it, but it is having a theatrical run next year. So. Very much looking forward to seeing that. Is it similar at all to Scarfies? Because I know it's got a kind of a similar premise.
Yeah, it's notionally like a horror movie, but really it's just like a bit of a stoner comedy with some real sort of early Peter Jackson-esque humour, just some kind of gory moments. But it's mostly pretty funny and very, just that real dry New Zealand humour. So I do recommend that film.
Awesome. Now, you took a big break from publishing books with your last book, Concept Albums, coming out in 2013. How does it feel to have something new hit the shelves? You know, does this release feel the same as the other ones?
No, it feels very different. I feel a lot more in control of what I'm writing. I've been writing on New Zealand music for 20 years or more, as a journalist and as a historian, really, since I did the Hip Hop one, which was 20 years ago. Oh my god. And I just saw over time that there were more and more a lot of sort of niche books which were very cool, like Needles and Plastic, covering the first 8 years of Flying Nun in New Zealand. But I sort of thought, there hasn't been one for a very long time that actually takes a high level view and gives you an overview of the whole history of music in this country. And I thought it's really needed, because only when you take a high level view can you see the wood for the trees, and you can see things like what was the real effect of Flying Nun, or what was the effect of the alcohol laws that introduced 6 o'clock closing for 40 years, that meant you couldn't go and see a band in a bar for those 40 years basically, because you couldn't get a drink in a licensed venue after six. So the music scene and the alcohol scene were completely different. But then when it came back, you had the opposite crazy situation where Lion Breweries took over the live scene for like 10 years in the 70s. So I just thought a book like this, then you can, yeah, you can see the whole path over time of New Zealand music, and you can see why different acts were important. Whereas with those niche kind of ones, they're really great at being in depth and telling the individual stories, but you kind of get lost about what it all means in the bigger picture, I guess.
They're not super broad as yours is, and you know, surprising, your book is around 200 pages before you start getting into the what do you call it, just a list of songs. Did you think of making it a bit longer, or did you really want to try and keep it as succinct as possible so that you didn't just kind of go on and on and on?
I really wanted it super succinct, and what I found about that is actually kind of harder to write a short book than it is to write a long book. But I, yeah, as I say, I really feel like having a short book that's sort of lengthwise is the length of a novel, but obviously it's a bit bigger because it has lots of photos and illustrations and stuff, and so it still looks a bit like a coffee table book, but you can sit down and just read it from front to back like a novel, and there's enough kind of fun stories and stuff that you can read it. Otherwise, I feel like other books that are too in-depth become a bit encyclopedic, and sometimes you end up just sort of listing a band in one sentence and then the next band and then the next band, and you kind of lose track. Whereas, you know, maybe in a book like this, you know, rather than just saying, oh, Dunedin, Flying Nun, and you get this really limited sort of view, but then get really in-depth in that limited view, instead you can go back, oh, right, Dunedin, the Tumbleweeds, this country band that really started the country scene in New Zealand, started in Dunedin, and it goes right through. Then you have Flying Nun, then you have 660, you have this whole spread, and you can see the huge change over time rather than getting so far in the weeds that you can't get perspective.
I like that approach a lot. I want to talk about one through line I've noticed for New Zealand music in the past, and that is that, you know, New Zealand used to be very isolated from the rest of the world. We'd be repeating trends and investigating sounds far after they'd come and gone overseas. For example, the droney 60s sounds of many a Dunedin sound band during the 1980s, you know, they were all kind of influenced by the likes of the Velvet Underground and so on and so forth, but they were looking at those sounds kind of retrospectively in the 80s. With the world being more integrated, do you think that we are at the fore of music now in ways that we weren't back in the day, or is there still that kind of that isolationism at play?
I think it's kind of a bit of both now, which is good. Yeah, like you say, it was really bad. Like in the 70s, you know, you could only get the limited amount of records that importers brought into stores, and then you actually couldn't import more than $100 worth of records from overseas. So there was no way to personally order records from overseas beyond a certain level. Nice. So when people got into punk, they had to like, who has this record? And then they'd share the one record around or whatever. And so one particular radio show would be the one that everyone had to listen to hear these records, otherwise you wouldn't hear them. And yeah, in the 60s, say Ray Columbus or whatever was ahead of the curve because he played shows at the army base and so could listen to the local the American GI's records and stuff. And so, yeah, it was really limited. And the other thing is, trying to go overseas in those days, you had to convince a whole bunch of people before you could get your physical CD into a record store in America or somewhere. And then, you know, you had to convince a lot of people if you wanted to get it in, say, 200 record stores, which is the only way to become sort of successful there. So now we have this instant access. We can put our music up and it's accessible overseas if people are interested, and we can hear the latest from overseas. But at the same time, yeah, we have these little live scenes that mean our bands can't always tour overseas, and so they spend a long time in New Zealand sort of feeding off each other and building up these little scenes. Like I think of in Auckland, you know, the way that Tom Scott's music and Avondale Bowling Club and Homebrew has made a lot of the hip-hop acts quite into jazz in a way that I don't see in overseas acts. And so, yeah, you can have things like that build for quite a while separate from what's trends from overseas. So it's a great sort of mix of both now, I think.
That's awesome. That kind of push and pull relationship seems to have stabilized a little bit more.
That's
awesome. What is your personal favorite decade of New Zealand music?
That's so tough. I mean, I'm so personally invested in, you know, because I do a little bit of work for Little Chief Records. So, I'm so personally invested in those early 2000s when we started the label and there was a fun sort of buzz around, bands like the Brunettes and, even other bands like the Chicks and stuff when they very first started. But I'm still really excited by current music. I'll be listening to Jim Nothing or the latest hip hop act or whatever. Like, I actually, my friends ask me what music is. They know I write about music, so they're like, "Oh, what's the best, you know, great new band from overseas we should be listening to?" And I'm like, "Oh, I listen to, like, I don't know, like 75% New Zealand music, because I'm always trying to keep up." So I feel like, better to ask about local music than I am about overseas music. I don't always keep up well.
Now, fair enough. I think I've become a little bit that way as well. It's quite funny. But it means that the message of New Zealand music is going out there to more people, which is always a good thing, yeah?
Yeah, I'm always excited. There's always little scenes that you don't know about, and you can dig into now so much more easily. You discover one, and then it's kind of like this vein that you can follow through to discover all these other ones. What's that band? Is it Dazed on a Pony? Is that the Dunedin band?
Phased on a Pony, I think.
Phased on a Pony?
Yeah,
like that whole set of bands. You know, I just heard of one of them, and then I was like, oh, there's a cassette label down there. And then they, you know, it was jumping through a couple of different bands before I discovered that one. And I was like, man, this band's great. But yeah, I don't know how I would have found them without that connectivity of the modern world.
So true. In the book, you write that the first ever music recorded for release in Aotearoa was singer Anahato in 1927. Now, around this time, Māori began incorporating more European melodies in their waiata. How did these two forces of Māori music and European music come to shape each other down the road?
Yeah, it was quite... it's hard to know where to draw the line, because I don't want to be saying that, like, some of these waiata are pop music. I don't want to lean into that too heavily, but there was definitely, like, you know, especially around Rotorua, where there was a tourism hub, there was this sort of idea amongst Maori, if we put in some of these light operatic kind of sounds and approaches and use a guitar and stuff, it's so much more accessible to the tourists. And so they did start writing these new songs that we almost think of as traditional, like Pōkarikariana, but that was kind of written in that fusion period. And so I feel like that's gone right through to the, like, Marlon Williams album now. There's this kind of distinctive guitar sound that they found, a strumming pattern or whatever, that worked well with the way waiata was sung. And you can even hear that in things like Don't Dream It's Over. I think the weird thing is that music in Te Reo Māori was so popular that Hal Morrison could release Hoki Mai and sell, you know, tens of thousands of copies of it in the 60s, and then there was this shyness about Te Reo Māori music where it was like, oh, can't play that on the radio, that's not going to be popular. And now we're actually come back around again where music in Te Reo Māori is popular, and it seems like controversial, or like a revolution that has to happen. And it's kind of like, oh, well, it used to be, we just kind of lost our way, lost our confidence in our own music for 20 years.
That's quite strange. It's cultural amnesia. It could be that. It could put down to that.
Yeah, I think there was just a big cultural cringe in the 80s and 90s. I feel like even in the 60s, because we were so isolated, we had these pop stars who'd play on TV and they'd tour the country and they'd be all over radio and everyone knew who they were and we were really proud of them. Then again, a lot of those acts did cover versions, so it was still, we weren't really backing our own songwriters. But yeah, so it was a long grind to be really confident in ourselves, but that yeah, that changed so much in the 90s. It's hard to, I think a book like this is good for young people to read and be like, oh wow, it was so bad. Like commercial radio would play like 1% New Zealand music or 2%. And even in the early 90s, it's like, wow, people did not believe in local music. And even something like Don't Dream It's Over, when it was first released here, it didn't get played on radio very much. It became a hit in Australia way before in New Zealand, and it even charted in America, I think, before it got in the top 20 here, probably.
It's the same thing with Poirier. They'd never got radio coverage until I think it was proven to be very, very popular. But it took a while. It took a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think a book like this, yeah, you can see things like that, or you can see, you know, streaming has obviously got a lot of horrible points and pays badly. But then if you go back 60 years, you realize, oh, there was a time before bands selling recorded music on a physical item. So, you know, pre-1960s, bands had to tour to survive, and now we've kind of come back around to that again. So maybe that whole era of selling a physical item was a blip, and something new will come to replace it. I don't know. Yeah.
Potentially. So, potentially. Well, speaking of blips, there's a bit of a blip in the 50s and 60s in Aotearoa's music. There's kind of a weird stagnance as New Zealand musicians would opt to redo other music from overseas, or they'd make really corny stuff like the songs I Love the Land, New Zealand Is My Home, and She'll Be Right. These are all real songs, as well as Rod Dyrdek's Rugby, Racing and Beer. Around this time, you also have Johnny Devlin, who's basically an Elvis impersonator. all this comes under a section called Quirky Hits and Kiwiana Nationalism. Why do we get hits like Rugby, Racing and Beer and She'll Be Right?
Well, that is part of that sort of embarrassment of ourselves, especially among Pākehā, who saw themselves as a lesser version of England or whatever. And it's funny you say Johnny Devlin. As soon as he moved to Australia and became famous there, he did start writing his own hits, and even wrote hits for other acts like the Denvermen overseas and stuff. So he had songwriting talent, but in New Zealand you just couldn't get played on the radio. And Ray Columbus even did a whole album of original numbers, and that did way worse than all the covers. So instead there was this weird culture of you try and get the 7-inch from overseas by an overseas band and quickly do your version before the original could arrive in bulk. And so you could have a hit with a big song from overseas before the original even got here, because it'd be on a ship slowly making its way across the world to us. I mean, those quirky songs, there's always these little bursts of songwriting. Like in the late 1800s, people would write a lot of the main sheet music that would sell was about the latest war that New Zealand was involved in. And so like the Boer War had all these songs written about it and stuff. So there's these weird sort of bursts. But I think, I am entertained by those quirky hits. Even in the 80s, there was like Life Begins at 40 and a Shoop Shoop Diddy Wop and so forth. I don't know. What do we have in the modern world? Jay Geek and the Geeks? I don't know.
Well, you mentioned the Boer War before, and some of those jingoistic compositions that would come around during wartime. We also had some more of those during World War One. Now, the earliest protest song I can think of that made the mainstream in New Zealand was Damn the Dam by John Hanlon. Were there any protest songs that came out for the Boer War or World War One, for example?
No, it's funny how it was such a monoculture, and especially amongst Pākehā, it was very nationalistic. It's funny, yeah. It's a different way of thinking about things, isn't it? To think, yeah, that everyone would sit at home on a piano and sing a song about a war. People are not at home now. I don't think anyone wrote a pro-Vietnam song wouldn't have been popular and stuff, so... a different time.
That's an example of how, you know, politics sort of sits at the top of the structure of society, and culture is downriver from that. So everything that happens through culture always emanates from politics is kind of the vibe that I got from reading that passage.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, the fun bit of this book, Songs from the Shakehouse, is you can see how politics comes through, even when it comes to something like say gay rights. You know, like a lot of there were there was one particular pop star, and one of the hosts of one of the big TV shows, they were like gay men, but they stayed in the closet basically till right at the end of their lives because it was seen as so detrimental to your career and stuff. So it was only like right on the cusp of 1990 that we had our first out gay man who had a hit. We've gone wild on the charts and stuff. Obviously, before that, we had the Top Twins because lesbianism was seen not quite as harshly and wasn't
more favourably, I think.
Yeah, but it's funny how you can see those politics coming through. I don't go too deep into them in this book, but taking the wide view of music history, you can see all these different currents coming through. Mm. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. There's tons of currents to look through. I'm really looking forward to getting through to the rest of this book because it is so fascinating. It's so fascinating. I like that it also is contemporary. It comes up till today, which is...
That's the trickiest bit, though, writing that last chapter, because it's like, I don't know who's going to be the historically important groups in like 10 years' time. So I had to sort of put my money on a few of them. But I excluded a lot of bands that my own band would play with or whatever, because they're quite small and just starting out. So I might have to like avoid going to my local, you know, whammy bar music venue. And seeing these bands, I'll be like, why am I not in the book? Why am I not in the book? Like, you haven't earned it yet. Sorry.
You mean the next one, you know.
Yeah, you can be in the next one. Keep working and I'll get back to you in 20 years' time.
Oh, man, that's cracker. Well, thank you for coming on and talking to me about this new book, Songs from the Shaky Isles. I really appreciate it, Gareth. Do you have any final words for our lovely listeners?
It should be available in most bookstores. You know, I've seen it in Wickles, and or support your local independent bookstore. And I hope people enjoy it. Thanks for having me on.
Of course, anytime, Gareth. And I hope you get back to making some cool music, and hope you are getting back into making books permanently. It'd be cool to see more stuff.
Thanks, man.
Cheers. All right, folks, that was Gareth Shute. We're talking to him about Songs from the Shaky Isles, his new book, which is available at Aotearoa Books, Paper Plus, Kete Books, and Whitcools.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.